This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
Is part of the Frog Pants Studios network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Welcome to the Sword and Laser Podcast, episode number 107. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is the audio version of the Sword and Laser Show, where we talk about our favorite books, talk about all the things you guys are discussing over in the forums, and keep you up to date on all the news.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we start, because it's the audio podcast, mm-hmm. with what we're drinking, which I was drinking right then.
Oh, that's why there was that awkward pause. That was the drinking.
Yes,
pardon
me.
I timed it poorly, is what you're saying.
I timed my drinking poorly. Bear Republic Racer 5 India Pale Ale is what
nice
I'm having
IPA.
Today.
Fancy. Mm-hmm.
Tasty.
I am drinking a red wine. I don't remember the name of it. That is not because I'm drunk. I am not. I poured it out of the bottle. I forgot to look at the name and now I don't remember. I bought it in Hawaii, but it is not Hawaiian. I don't think they make wine there. Correct me if
I'm
wrong.
They might make wine there, but it's probably not very good.
They have great beer.
I don't think it's the right climate for making wine. I'm sure they make some wine. Everybody makes wine everywhere now. Like places like Missouri make wine.
That's true.
So, I don't know.
Apparently, I learned that Toronto or the surrounding area around Toronto has a burgeoning wine country, which I found to be very interesting. I just returned from Toronto today.
Oh, how was Toronto?
It was lovely. I swear I would gain about 300 pounds if I lived there because I can't control my poutine habit.
They have great writers in Toronto also.
Yes, and a very nice film and video industry as well. So kudos to Toronto. I enjoyed your fine city. It was my first time.
You know what they say? Toronto is the Mexico City of Canada.
Do they say that?
No, nobody says that.
I didn't think that. Okay. Just making sure. But as we always do, let's kick this episode off with the quick burns.
Game of Thrones news from our favorite Game of Thrones news source, Adam Whitehead at The Word Zone. First up, HBO has decided where they're shooting River Run.
Yeah.
It's going to be located at Gosford Castle in County Armagh. both exteriors and interiors being filmed there, and he suspects they must be CG in the Red Fork and the Tumblestone Rivers. But
I'm so excited. That's one of my favorite locations, and I'm thrilled to see how they fix it up for the show. Gosh, we are getting close to the next season. I'm looking forward to it so much.
Yeah.
And then also we have something we don't talk about very much in the show, which is probably to our detriment, is fairy tales. And IO9 is reporting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Before we get to the fairy tales, George R. R. Martin, speaking in an interview, said that he has completed 200 pages of The Winds of Winter.
Why didn't he say that on our show?
And he's and a further 200 pages in draft form. He probably hadn't finished them
yet. Maybe he wasn't done them yet.
He wasn't ready.
I guess I can't.
That means The Winds of Winter exists in at least an initial form.
Yay!
Hey, okay, on to the fairy tales.
That means that my NaNoWriMo is about as long as The Winds of Winter. I can say that right
so
now.
So far.
I can say that for now. Yeah, for like another day until he starts writing another like 600 pages.
Yeah.
But anyway, as I was saying, fairy tales. Charlie Jane Anders over on IO9 has a story about a wonderful book that she read called Some Kind of Fairy Tale, which is like a fantasy. I think it's a kind of like an urban fantasy fairy tale story.
Yeah.
It has to do with maybe
loosely
not urban.
Fits into that, it seems like. Yeah.
Okay, maybe not urban. More more, I don't even know if it's modern, but well, anyway, the girl in the story, the main character, Tara Martin, she vanishes and then returns 20 years later and has not appeared to have aged at all. And which is funny because actually that's a pretty common trope that we see. When people disappear to the fairyland, they don't age.
Thinking of Sookie Stackhouse?
Yeah. That's not my only fairy interpretation, mm-hmm. But there are others, and that is what happens in this situation. She returns after 20 years of being in fairy, and she is, you know, not unchanged. And I'm excited to, I added this to my to-read list, because judging from what Charlie says on IO9, it sounds like a pretty great book.
Yeah, Graham Joyce is the author, and it's... As Charlie Jane Anders says, it takes a subtle tack, showing a bunch of different characters' view of what's happened to Tara, including her boyfriend who was suspected of murder
because
of her disappearance. Graham Joyce never tries to play the, is she crazy? It's sort of like, no, she really went to Fairyland, but of course not everybody necessarily believes her. But the reader is supposed to believe her, and it's kind of a psychological fairy tale, like a psycho thriller, but fairy tale, not thriller.
Yes, and you have to. She does do a lot of descriptions of her time in fairy. So what I like is that it seems like it doesn't actually ever take place in fairy. It's not like a first person perspective of being there. It's kind of the recounting of her experiences there.
It's fairy realism.
Fairy realism.
Fairy realism. Scott Lynch has set up a new blog at Lynch Industries. I believe it's Lynch Industries, scottlynch.us/blog.
Yes.
So it says, so Lynch Industries is just the name, but you go to scottlynch.us/blog. And he's updated on the status of the Republic of Thieves. It's fallen behind schedule, but he's still revising it. So it's still happening.
Oh, and sad news. I'm sad about this. Apparently, as we may have mentioned on the show previously, The Lies of Lochlan Mara, which is one of our previous book picks, had been optioned several years ago to be a film. And apparently the option has lapsed. So unless someone picks up the project again, it's probably going to be dead in the water.
That happens. Options lapse sometimes.
Maybe it'll get picked up still. Maybe someone will be listening to this show and hear how passionate we are about how much we love that book.
If you or someone you love is a director of movies or producer of movies, pick up the option now.
Just pick it up. It can't be that much,
pick
right?
Pick up the phone in a telephone.
Can we do like a Kickstarter?
Just go pick up the option. Help us make The Lies of Lochlan Mara into a movie.
It's nice to have options.
Yeah, it is. I'd love to see that as a movie. Of course, right hands. You know, you don't want to, like...
You don't want to screw it up.
Maligned.
You don't want to golden compass it, if you know what I'm saying.
That was the worst thing I've seen happen to a movie, but yeah, it was a bit disappointing.
Yeah. Also, over on gizmag.com, they have an article called Sci-Fi Writers of the Past Predict Life in 2012. This was a bit of a TLDR for me, Tom. So maybe you can better explain what this article is about.
Back in 1987, there was an award called the L. Ron Hubbard Writers of the Future Award, and they got a group of science fiction writers to put together a time capsule of their predictions of what life in the year 2012 would look like.
Ooh.
Orson Scott Card, Robert Silverberg, Jack Williamson, Algis Budrys, Frederick Pohl, all contributed this among many others. And so it's really interesting to just kind of scan through what these folks thought. These are science fiction writers. Their job is to imagine the future, and they were imagining what our world today would be like. I'm going to jump right down to Frederick Pohl. Here's what he said. He's writing to the people of 2012, so he's writing to us. Mm-hmm. You live in a world at peace. Something like the World Court, as an arm of something like the United Nations, resolves international disputes and has the power to enforce its decisions. For that reason, you live in a world almost without weaponry. And because you therefore do not have to bear the crippling financial burden of paying for military establishments and hardware, all of you enjoy an average standard of living about equal to contemporary millionaires. Your health is generally superb. Your life expectancy is not much less than a century. The most unpleasant and debilitating jobs, heavy industry, mining, large-scale farming, are given over to machines. most work performed by human beings is in some sense creative. The exploration of space is picking up speed both by manned colonization and robot probes and by vast orbiting telescopes and other instruments. Deforestation, desertification, and the destruction of arable land has been halted and even reversed. Pollution is controlled, and all the winds and the waters of the earth are sweet again. So it starts off, you're thinking, wow, Friedrich, you got it all wrong. We do not have a world at peace. You know, we do have something like a world court, but it doesn't really work that well. But then he goes on and he hits a few notes. Life expectancy is about less than a century. It's like getting close to that. Health is much improved. There are vast orbiting telescopes and robot exploration of the solar system, though the manned colonization part didn't work out very well.
And pollution. We're not quite at the winds and waters of the earth being sweet.
Pollution is controlled, though. Think about 1987.
Oh, yeah. It's gotten, I guess, the...
Relatively speaking, yeah. I mean, I think he overstates where it is now, but it certainly is much better than it was back then.
Also, Gregory Benford was probably the most correct according to this article. I will be old, but not dead. Come by and see me and bring a bottle.
And he's right.
And he is still writing and probably also drinking and visiting with friends.
Yeah.
So I like that. I love time capsule stuff like that. I think it's always a lot of fun. And even if people, you're almost never right. Like, that's one of the things that always drove me crazy, like working in the tech industry, because every year you get asked, what are your predictions for the next year? What do you think is going to be the hot new trend? What do you think is going to be the top product? And you have to basically kind of like make an educated bullshit answer.
Yeah, it's just a guess.
It's just a guess. But it's like, if you're wrong, people are going to call back to that and be like, oh, you were way off with that.
They,
if you're right, no one notices.
They almost. No, I think it's the opposite. If you're wrong, nobody ever notices. You rarely
really,
have
like
people...
John C. Dvorak in 2006 saying the iPhone was going to be a colossal failure. I remember that.
Well, you do, but... I rarely get people bringing up old predictions that I've made that were wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas the thing about being right is then you bring it up all the time. Like, oh, yeah, I predicted that.
I totally called that one. Over on Boing Boing, classic sci-fi of the 1950s are being published by the Library of America. They're publishing two volumes, a two-volume treasure of science fiction, which has a lot of great classics in there, including Frederick Pohl. And others such as Robert Heinlein, James Blish, Fritz Lieber, who else is in there? Theodore Sturgeon. A lot of great authors in there. It looks like the cover is really cool, too.
And the site for the books at loa.org/science fiction has essays and a bunch of supplementary material, including William Gibson writing about The Stars of My Destination, Neil Gaiman about The Big Time, Kit Reed on More Than Human, and Connie Willis on Double Star. So you get the supplementary material from these great authors who are sort of introducing you to the works you can find in the book. I think that's a great way to sell the printed book, but also have an online companion that gives you more enjoyment.
Nice. All right, well, let's take a moment to check out what's coming up in the near future over on our calendar. Now, we're changing things a little bit. It's going to be a little more abbreviated, but you can click through all the titles over on the calendar to learn more about each book that we're talking about.
Yeah, we took out all the descriptions on the calendar, so it should be easier to see what's coming up, and we put in the schedule for the show itself, both our video show on YouTube and this audio podcast.
Mm-hmm. And now we don't have to say all the words that are really hard to pronounce.
August 6, 2012 will be the Sword and Laser podcast, which you're listening to right now.
On August 7th, we have Sharon's Claw, or no, wait, sorry.
Karen's Claw.
Karen's Claw. No, that's not right either.
Yes.
Karen in Karen's Astronomy.
Claw. Or in Astronomy, Sharon.
Or in Astronomy, Sharon. Karen's Claw, or in Astronomy, Sharon. Neverwinter Saga, book 3.
You're going to have
three,
to go watch your own episode to find out what you said.
By R.A. Salvatore. We also have King of Thorns, The Broken Empire by Mark Lawrence, Biting Cold, a Chicagoland Vampires novel, and Chloe Neal.
I'm sorry, I'll fix that.
Tom screwed up the formatting.
There's a line break. Embarrassing.
Line break in the wrong
so
place.
Embarrassing.
Oh, you messed up everything. Biting Cold, a Chicagoland Vampires novel by Chloe Neal, and Star Wars X-Wing number 10, Mercy Kill by Aaron Alston.
Also, I didn't capitalize Chicagoland.
Way to go.
Be revoked as a citizen of Boy.
This is why I have to.
I don't know. It looks right to me. I just fixed it, and now it looks right. August 17th, 2012, Sword and Laser video with guest Adam Christopher,
Yay.
Author of The Empire State and also the upcoming novel Seven Wonders. And, of course, August 20th, we'll have another audio podcast. Then looking ahead, August 21st, Wards of Faerie, The Dark Legacy of Shannara by Terry Brooks. Fate of Worlds, Return from Ringworld by Larry Niven and Edward M. Lerner, and The Unincorporated Future by Danny Collin and Aiton Collin.
Nice. A lot of good stuff coming up. And of course, this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. I'm hearing myself in your speakers again, Tom. I'm just letting you know.
No, you're not. You can't be.
I am too.
Do you hear it now?
Hello. No.
Well, I didn't do anything.
For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Long Earth by Stephen Baxter and Terry Pratchett, which is available now on Audible for just one little credit. And of course, you can get that for free if you go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword to get your free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget that Terry Pratchett, like Dodgers coming out in the fall and everybody's really excited about that, but he has a book out right now with Stephen Baxter, and it takes place across many time periods, so it's kind of part historical, part futuristic. It's a really cool concept. I'm looking forward to checking this one out myself.
I've got a lot of books to catch up on Audible right now. I'm listening to Heartless by Gail Carriger. Actually, maybe I just finished it. No, I still have to listen to part two. I also have The Privilege of the Sword, part one by Ellen Kushner, and Year Zero by Rob Reed, who we interviewed on the show.
Oh, I have to do that. Even though I already read it, I have to listen to the Hodgman audiobook.
Yeah. I also have The Sagan Diary by John Scalzi. So I've got a lot of good stuff that I got to catch up on.
I'm listening to Assassin's Apprentice, and I will talk about it in the book check-in, but absolutely enjoying that book.
Awesome. All right, well, now it's time for Barrier Sword, which is our feedback from the audience. Now, this was a funny thread. This one was started by Nick, who wrote that Patrick Rothfuss was linking to an article by Neil Gaiman, which was about how to seduce a writer. What is the best way to seduce a writer? Bird Art Poetry asked Mr. Gaiman, "You're kick-ass. I was just wondering, what do you think is the best way to seduce a writer? I figured your answer would be pretty spectacular." Would you like to read his answer in the voice of Neil Gaiman?
No, I will not read it in the voice of Neil Gaiman because that would be insulting to Neil Gaiman. But I'll make an attempt at reading the answer. He says, "In my experience, writers tend to be really good at the inside of their own heads and imaginary people and a lot less good at the stuff going on outside, which means that quite often if you flirt with us, we will completely fail to notice, leaving everybody involved slightly uncomfortable and more than slightly unlaid." Mm. So I would suggest that any attempted seduction of a writer would probably go a great deal easier for all parties if you sent them a cheerful note saying, "You are invited to a seduction. Please come to dinner on Friday night. Wear the kind of clothes you would like to be seduced in. And alcohol may help too. Or kissing. Many writers figure out that they're being seduced or flirted with if someone is actually kissing them."
So you got to go for like, gotta be obvious. I think is what he's saying here is you need to be obvious.
And it sparked this big discussion of like, I know writers who aren't like that. And, oh, it sounds like geeks. And is this a stereotype? Is he feeding a stereotype?
And then Tamahome said, okay, maybe it's just science fiction writers. Maybe.
Maybe. Although I would submit that the reason some people may have seen varied results regarding writers is that what Neil Gaiman is giving advice to is someone who wants to seduce a writer. So you're approaching the writer and saying, "I want to make you interested in me." What other people may have experienced is a writer being interested in you, which is a whole different situation. You're trying to get the attention of the writer. And so and in that case, they may be a little oblivious.
I like it. I do see the parallels with geekitude as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crossover.
I definitely have been caught being oblivious in my past.
Aww.
Oh, I wondered why I didn't try to kiss her on our second date. And it was exactly somebody in the chat room or in this thread said the same thing. They're like, my girlfriend at the time once thought I wasn't interested. It's because you're like, I can't believe a person that awesome would be interested in me. They're just humoring me by hanging out with me.
What I like is that I'm thinking that this is how Neil Gaiman would like to be seduced.
By someone going,
it's like a manual. No, not like that. No, like writing him a little note saying, you are invited to a seduction.
I think that would be great. I absolutely agree. It's like everything is clear from the beginning. Okay, I know what I'm in for.
Well, of course, he must have been paying some attention because he is married to the wonderful and very talented Amanda Palmer. So
maybe she sent him a note.
Maybe.
That said you were invited to a celebrity. Maybe this that's actually his
maybe
experience.
This is autobiographical.
It could be.
It's possible. And then there was another great thread that was started by Leslie, who writes, I don't know if this topic exists somewhere else on this board. I cannot find it. I did find its polar opposite. The thread is called More, M-O-A-R, More Kids. She says, most of the other members heartily agreed that they don't like kids in books. It made me feel kind of sad because one of the reasons I've actually been collecting certain books instead of just checking them out at the library was for my two sons to read them when they come of age. I especially like the books with kids as protagonists. Kids can be great characters when they're well written. When I was a child, I loved reading about kids doing great things, and I still love it. So I wanted to create a book list that highlights some well-written children's characters. My first two entries are His Dark Materials, of course, which is the first book is The Golden Compass, and Good Omens, the nice and accurate prophecies of Agnes Nutter, which...
Hey, those are two of our book clubs.
We've read.
Yeah.
Now, I was trying to remember, I guess the kids in Dark Omens, I don't know if I would think of them as...
Good Omens, you mean?
Good Omens. What did I say?
Dark Omens.
Oh, well, you know what I was
talking about. So I wasn't sure if you meant Dark Materials or Good Omens.
You don't know which book I was talking about. In Good Omens, the kids are kind of... Well, I guess the group of kids that are around the main kid are awesome. The main kid is kind of scary.
Well, yeah, and that makes sense. But those are good. Those are interesting kid characters.
Mm-hmm.
Even if not all of them are good,
right?
Quote unquote. They're definitely dynamic. Terp Kristen mentioned, of course, Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow.
Mm-hmm. And Raznik recommended Arya Stark, who is one of the best kid characters in my memory.
Absolutely.
Of course, he also goes on to mention Joffrey.
Yeah, well, it's one of the worst.
A well-written kid character, though.
Yeah, for sure. Leslie pointed out that I went to the library and was surprised to find For the Win in the young adult section. Not that it's not appropriate for teenagers, but it's a complex novel dealing with a lot of abstraction, even though the main characters are teenagers. For the Win, Cory Doctorow's book, was written as a young adult novel, specifically for young adults, because he wanted to write something that wasn't condescending to them, something that was complex and had abstraction for the kids who are out there saying, don't dumb it down for me.
You know, I really like in the Codex Solera, the main characters, I'm typing now because I'm trying to figure out I'm trying to remember the name of the kid. Tavi. I love him as a character too, and he's definitely doing a whole coming of age thing in that series as well.
The Magicians.
Yeah,
they don't stay kids, but they're high schoolers at the very beginning.
Yeah. So there's a lot of kid characters in books, but I agree that sometimes it can be a little bit frustrating. And I think that's what a lot of the people in the other forum threads are kind of reacting to, is that you know, kids make a lot of decisions that we as adults wouldn't necessarily make because we're better informed or we've just had more life experience or, you know, we know better. So it's hard to relate sometimes to a much younger person in a book when you are an adult, because you kind of understand the rest of the situation better than that kid does, obviously, but you're coming at it from a different perspective. But I think kids react to other kids in books a lot better because they can relate more, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you want a book that only speaks to you and your experiences, then that's not going to work if you're not a kid anymore. But that's boring to me. And there could be good kid novels. There could be bad kid novels. I love The Hunger Games. That's a young adult book.
That's
but
true.
It's an excellent world with interesting characters. And even if they're frustrating sometimes, believe me, Katniss is very frustrating. You're looking at her like, oh, come on, grow up. Oh, right, you're whatever, you're 14, 16. but that, you know, I'm also not an astronaut, and I'm also, you know, not an evil dictator. And I still enjoy books that have those characters in them. And I'm still frustrated with them because they do things differently than me. But that's what makes books interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, should we head over to some TV shows, movies, video games, et cetera?
Well, we have another barrier sword.
We do. Oh, you added one. Okay.
You told me to add.
Oh, yeah. No, seriously, guys. I've only had like 2 sips of wine. I'm just having fun tonight.
Only 2 bottles of wine.
So, Renegade Wine. You made me say Renegade Wine. Renegade Reads for August, apparently, are happening for August, September. This is started by Jenny.
This isn't an alternate pick. This isn't a group pick. This is a Renegade Read.
It's a Renegade Read. Sassy. Jenny started this thread, and she is going to reread Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell starting in August. She says, I figured a bunch of people would be doing it too, so I declared a Renegade Read. I'm still going to read Assassin's Apprentice, so this is no statement on the official pick, but rather a place to discuss what I suspect a lot of us will be reading anyway. Who is with me?
Well, now, I went and posted on this. I just discovered it today. She posted it on July 28th. I wrote, this was a very wise thing to do. If you can, you might want to join her.
I wonder why you would say that.
Why would I say that,
why would
Veronica?
You say that? Why would you say that, especially for September?
Not for September.
No, not for September.
Maybe October.
Maybe October. Maybe you should read it by October.
Because September is going to be The Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
It is, and I'm already reading it.
There, I said it.
Oh, now you guys know all sorts of things.
There, I've been holding this in so long. It feels so good to get it out.
Look,
also, it was on
the
revised
know.
Calendar that I just posted.
It's on the
earlier.
Calendar now, so that's...
Yeah.
So now you know that. You can also find it on the internet. Yes, Assassin's Apprentice is our pick for August. September is going to be Foundation by Isaac Asimov. And then who knows what's going to happen?
I have every idea, actually, what's going to happen in October. A pretty good idea in November, and The Hobbit in December.
It will be The Hobbit in December. So if you're looking to start that that read, maybe now is a good time because it's kind of long. It's one of our longer picks, I think.
The Cloud Atlas, not The Hobbit.
No, how long is The Hobbit?
Hobbit's not that bad.
It's not that long?
No. It's no Lord of the Rings, believe me.
Okay. All right. Well, then, take your time. Now we will talk about movies. So we've mentioned in the past that Neuromancer has been, you know, in the rolling around the bowels of Hollywood for quite some time.
Rolling in the deep like Adele.
Rolling in the deep. And apparently Lorenzo Di Bonaventura wants
Mark Wahlberg to
play the Neuromancer.
Mark Wahlberg?
Mark Wahlberg. Hey, he's a good actor. He's not bad. He's not a bad actor.
Well, apparently Liam Neeson has also been offered a part.
I would like that. I like Liam Neeson.
Lorenzo says, yeah, Wahlberg would play the anti-hero Case. Mm. Neeson would be Armitage. I can see Wahlberg as Case. I really can. He's got the mood for it. They'd have to make him look different. He can't look like Wahlberg because that's just not right. Neeson as Armitage? Maybe. That one's a little more of a stretch for me.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see. I mean, you know, these things can come and go as we've seen. But they're saying expected release is 2014.
I feel Armitage was more grizzled than Neeson. And not that Neeson is...
He can get pretty grizzled.
He can be a little grizzled, but I feel like more, I don't know, something more cowboy American for Armitage to me.
Cowboy American, like what's his face? What's his face? Why can't I remember
from
his
the
name?
Big Lebowski?
No. Nope. Can't remember his name, and he is one of the most famous actors in the world. And he's Indiana Jones.
Wilford Brimley? Oh, Harrison Ford?
Yes, thank you. Why couldn't I remember Harrison Ford's
name? Han Solo.
That's embarrassing.
Yeah, Harrison Ford, totally. I could see his Armitage. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good pick?
Yeah.
All right. Nice. I'm good at this game sometimes.
Wahlberg wouldn't be my first choice, but I could see him pulling off Case.
I just want Joseph Gordon-Levitt to be in every movie.
He would be a good choice.
Maybe they should hire him.
I keep saying he's a little young, but he's getting older all the time. So
you know, I was trying to figure out if I'm older than him. the other night because I went to see Batman.
You're never too old for Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, he's older than me. That's weird because he doesn't look older than me in my brain.
But he looks really young. You're right.
Yeah, he looks super young. Are you saying I look old?
No.
Did you just say?
No.
I look old. He's also taller than me.
No, he looks like he's 12. Is what
he
I'm
looks
saying.
Looks like a tiny, adorable little thing that you just want to put in your mouth.
He looks like a homunculus.
A kitten or something. He's a great actor.
Why are you always sticking kittens in your mouth?
I want to put cute things in my mouth. I don't know why. It's like an internet like I've Googled it before because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't alone. Hold on.
You just want to taste the cuteness?
No, I don't want to taste it. I just want to hold it there.
Okay. All right.
No?
I'm not here to judge.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying it's in no way creepy or like sexual or weird or anything like that. I just
Right.
like a little tiny baby chicken, or a tiny kitten, or maybe just like the kitten's face.
Maybe a little weird.
Or just like a puppy or like a hamster.
Maybe we should bring Charlie Jane Anders up for the second time this episode because she has an article up about possible science fiction authors who could be Hollywood's next Philip K. Dick because
Philip
K. Dick's works have been mined for A Minority Report, Blade Runner, Total Recall. And with Total Recall coming out this weekend, I think they were looking for something to kind of catch people's attention. Who would be the next author that you could mine their works and turn them into amazing movies?
I love the idea. Okay, so there's three on this list that really, actually four, no, three, that really jumped out at me. And those would be Haruki Murakami, which I don't even know how you would make a movie
That's what makes them like Philip K. Dick, because when you read Philip K. Dick's novels, you're like, I don't know how anyone would make this into a movie. But what you do is you pull out the concept, not the story. So Minority Report is actually fairly close, but it's different. Blade Runner, totally different than Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. Total Recall, much different than We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. But you pull out. So, yeah, let's take 1Q84. You wouldn't try to tell that whole story, but you could.
I hope not.
The young girl who writes a novel and it's accidentally brilliant and they try to cover up the rewrite and then there's this cult. I mean, those are the elements of a great movie in there if you don't try to follow it too religiously.
It's very smart. And also Charlie Strauss, Neal Stephenson, and William Gibson, of course, who's already had, you know, some success, but the film they've made of William Gibson's was Johnny Mnemonic. So.
Yeah. Well, I it has a place in my heart.
Does it?
In the part of your heart that pushes things away.
Also, Octavia Butler, Cory Doctorow, some great writers.
Cory Doctorow. I think there's a lot of movie concepts, and especially in the short stories, which is another thing that they mined Philip K. Dick's short stories to make movies as well.
Yeah, so I would love to see some of these authors come to the big screen. I think that'll be a lot of fun. All right, well, as we mentioned, we are reading right now Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb from the Farseer Trilogy, book one. And so I've read it already. I've also reread it already. And are you enjoying it so far?
Yes, I am absolutely enjoying it. So spoiler alert, very minor spoiler alert, but if you're a purist, you might want to close your ears. I was enjoying it from the beginning. I'm like, okay, this is an interesting world where people are named after concepts and very interesting beginning with a boy being given up and we don't know anything about his parentage and he's telling it in the first person. But it was a book I was reading when I had a chance to read until we actually got to the town where they're checking on the towers. And when he meets the lady of that castle in the kitchen and he fixes the dog and then he gets called away to Lady Time's apartment suddenly, that turned things around. And suddenly it went from a book that I was reading when I had time and enjoying to a book that I was finding time to read because I enjoyed it.
Nice. So that makes me feel good. That's great. It is. I'm happy to report that I was a little concerned about rereading one of my favorite books of all time. But the reread proved to be just as enjoyable as the first time. So there was no sense of like, oh, I grew out of this, or oh, it's not as funny, or not funny, not as great as I remembered it to be. So I didn't experience that, and I'm rereading the second book as well now.
I was listening to it right up until we started the show, because he's in the training part with Galen,
Oh, yeah, that's a dark time.
He just had the crap kicked out of him. And I wanted to see what was going to happen. So I got to the point, I actually still am at the very end of that scene, but I got to the point where, you know, he basically is just lying there. And every piece of this novel from the point that I mentioned earlier on has just been pulling me through. I've just been absolutely loving it. It's a great story. Good characters. I love Burridge. I don't love the royalty so much yet, but maybe I just need to get to know them more. But I think Fitz is compelling, and I'm glad to have him as a narrator. And she's very good at just at the point where I was starting to forget that he was telling this in the first person. She kind of pops back in and lets you know a little bit about his forward story, just a tantalizing tidbit there, mm-hmm. to kind of remind you, like, don't forget how this started. He's trying to, you know, put something out of his mind, and it sort of teases you ahead to, like, okay, wait a minute. How does he get to that point? What is going on with him? What is he going to learn? So well constructed in that way, too.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
And I'm glad that you were able to reread it and still enjoy it, and it didn't ruin your childhood.
No, it did not crush my childhood. There's some great threads going on in the forums right now, particularly one that I spotted by Jenny, who said about the meaning of your name. And now, we mentioned that a lot of the characters, or most of the characters in the book, at least from the royalty point of view, are named with attributes that they hope to, you know, become.
Yeah, Regal should have been named Snotty.
Yeah, or like Douchebag.
Yeah. His Royal Highness Douchebag.
Douchebag of Buckkeep. Like, you know, chivalry and verity and shrewd and names like that that are supposed to inspire certain feelings, certain, you know, ways of presenting oneself. And so Jenny said, let's say your parents named you deliberately based on the meaning of your name. Share the meaning, Google search, and if you lived up to it. She says, my first name is Jennifer, which is of Welsh origin, meaning beautiful and smooth, sometimes white wave. Not really a personality trait. Those of you who are Glenn, Forrest, and Daisy will have a similar problem. So, Tom, yeah. did you do yours?
Yeah, well, I've known mine for a long time. Thomas is Aramaic for twin.
Oh.
Yeah. So it means, essentially, as I understand it, Aramaic families who had twins had a name picked out for the first baby and just didn't really know what to call the second baby, so they called them Thomas.
So you're like, okay.
Now, what's funny is you'll see in this thread a lot of people saying, well, the literal translation of my name is X, but the reason people named it was because of Y. And Thomas became popular as a name because St. Thomas from the Bible was the famous doubting Thomas. He was the one who was absent when Jesus came back after rising from the dead, and the other disciples told them, hey, we saw Jesus, and he was like, you know what? I don't think you did. So it also kind of has the meaning of skeptic.
Hmm. Oh, skeptic. That's interesting.
Doubting Thomas.
You are...
I don't know if I buy it.
Really?
Get it, because
skeptic. My name means victory bringer.
Yes, that rocks.
It's
now that's
also
a name.
Yeah, apparently Saint Veronica was supposed to have given a handkerchief to Jesus as he carried the cross to wipe his brow. I learned that in catechism. And the face of Jesus later appeared on the handkerchief. This is known as the Veil of Veronica. But I prefer Victory Bringer because that's badass.
Well, it's the same thing, right? Like, it literally means Victory Bringer, the way Thomas means twin. But you also have this association with it as well, which is cool.
Now I want to find like other meanings and stuff too.
Well, true image is sometimes thought of as the meaning of Veronica because of the Saint Veronica who got the true image of Christ on her veil and all of that.
Now, if you go to this very trustworthy site called blurtit.com, Anonymous writes, the name Veronica means a simply beautiful girl with an amazing sense of humor, good taste in music and movies. Anyone Aww. Would be lucky to have a Veronica. She's really faithful and there isn't a moment of boredom when you're with her. Veronica is amazing times infinity.
That was nice of Ryan to write that.
I don't know who that is, but you are my best friend now. I've terrible taste in movies, so.
What's your middle name? Are you willing to admit that on this podcast?
Yeah, it's on Wikipedia. Anne.
Oh, and Anne is in the thread. What is it? What does Anne mean? Because Anne wrote what Anne meant.
What Anne means.
Where is it?
I don't
try to find.
Oh no, I'm reading the wrong thread. Okay, where'd it go? Anne. I guess.
Where you at, Anne? I'm scrolling.
Where you at, Doug?
Anne, alternatively spelled Anne or Anne, which I'll pronounce the same, is form of the Latin female given name Anna. This is a representation of the Hebrew Hana or Hanani, meaning he has favored me. The name of the mother of the prophet of Samuel. Anne is common in France.
So I guess my name is kind of like the victory bringer because God has favored me.
It is sometimes used as a male name in the Netherlands. Weird.
And Belmont means beautiful mountains.
Well,
so I'm like, I brought victory to the beautiful mountains because God favored me.
Interesting. My middle name, Andrew, is a derivative of the Greek word andro, which means man.
So you're twin man.
Twin man.
Twin man Merritt.
And Merritt means merit, like to be deserving of something because you earned it.
Oh, you deserved a twin.
You deserve to be a twin man.
All right.
And I'm not even a twin.
That was fun. Are you sure you're not a twin? Did you eat a twin?
I am not a twin.
I
do not have a secret twin.
Are you sure?
I'm really sure. I'm like 100% sure.
You don't have like a little jawline sticking out of your elbow?
No, nothing like.
Okay.
Believe me, if I had even the hint of that, I'd be claiming it. Because that's awesome.
Like, check out my elbow. Tom mouthing off again.
It wasn't me.
This is why we don't let him wear short sleeve t-shirts.
I know. If I had been a girl, I would have been named Amy.
I would have been Nathan.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
What does Nathan mean? Now I want to know what Nathan means.
My mom was naming all of her children after the characters in Little Women, and then I came along and ruined it.
Nathan is a boy's name of Hebrew origin, and the meaning of Nathan is God has given.
You're all about, like, just victory and God.
Victory and, you know, God giving me shit and whatever. Yeah. That's
What's
awesome.
The meaning of Amy?
I apologize. I've been a little cursy this episode. I feel like we haven't done a podcast in a long time, so maybe
Amy means beloved.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I would
all your things are sweet and all of mine are really brutal.
What's sweet about twin man?
Because you had a twin. You're like, you know, bonded at birth.
It's not even correct.
Oh. Let's read a nice email from Dwayne.
All right, let's do.
Dwayne writes, "Dear Tom and Veronica, first of all, I love this show and I'm excited to be part of your book club. Thank you. I'd just like to thank you for this month's pick. I must admit I had my reservations about the novel. I'm not a huge fan of first-person narration, but I was quite surprised by how quickly the pages were turning. I was at the Half Price bookstore and on page 13, when my brother showed me what he'd intended to buy, the PlayStation version of Blood Omen: Legacy of Kain, then it occurred to me that I should have read the book using Simon Templeman's voice as the older Fitz relating his childhood. The book went from pretty interesting to nothing short of awesome. The voice of Cain going through your head, narrating a tale of a boy's travails as he learns the trait of killing people? What's not to love? Anyway, I thought you'd get a kick out of that. Once again, thank you so much for the pick. I can't wait to see how it turns out. Take care, guys. Yours truly, Dwayne."
So who voiced Cain in the video game? Because if we can figure that out, then Audible, you should hire this person to, I know they've already recorded it, so, that's pretty cool. That's a pretty awesome idea there.
Let's see. I'm looking up the voice acting here, just because I'm curious. A range of actors voice the characters. Da, 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 da.
Now go to IMDb. It was okay. Simon Templeman. Oh, so he says that in the email. What are we doing?
Oh, it is Simon. Oh,
yeah.
Ha! Apparently, I read things and don't actually absorb them. That's why
I heard
I'm
you read it.
Excellently suited for book clubs. I'm being nice. Sarcastic.
I know. Simon Templeman reading the Assassin's Apprentice. You know, actually, I could see that totally working. The author for Audible is British. So it's a different
spin. I didn't love the audiobook when I listened to it in your car.
It's okay. It's growing on me, actually. I'm starting to like it now.
maybe if I had started, I read this one, maybe if I had listened to it instead, you know, I would have caught on from the beginning and gotten used to it.
Well, and you have it in your head from being a kid too, right? So mm-hmm. when Paul Bomer reads it, suddenly you're like, that's not how Fitz sounds.
Right.
Yeah. Makes a difference.
All right. Well, I think that's all we've got today. Anything else you want to add? We've got some great interviews that are being lined up for the video show, by the way. So I'm very excited to get
you
to talk about
have
in
been
the
kicking ass, by the way.
Well, it's hard because I want to. I'm emailing these authors and I want to give them options for like when they want to be on the show. But then I can't like email other authors and give them the same options of dates because then I get worried that they're all going to pick the same date. You know what I mean? So maybe I should start asking them for particular
dates. It's a delicate balance, believe me, because I booked the show up until now, and it's you have to be careful. It all works out in the end, though.
That's great. Fantastic. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is feedback@swordandlaser. All of our shows and everything gets posted over on swordandlaser.com or youtube.com/geekandsundry. And if you want to join in the discussion, head over to goodreads.com and search for The Sword and Laser. And we will see you guys next time.
Or talk to you because we can't see on a